1230 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. A jury finds a scuba dive boat captain criminally negligent in the deaths of 34 people in a boat fire off the California coast. CBS's Matt Piper.
Jerry Boylan is found guilty of what's known as seaman's manslaughter. He was the captain of the boat Conception, anchored off California's coast, when it caught fire before dawn on the final day of a three-day excursion. 33 passengers and a crew member died, trapped in a bunk room below deck. Sherry McDonough lost her daughter, Alexandra.
We'll never get over it. She was so special. They all were special people. They all were unique and adventurous.
Boylan was the first to abandon ship and jump overboard in the 2019 tragedy. He could get 10 years in prison at sentencing. Matt Piper, CBS News.
After heated exchanges with the judge, former President Trump wraps up testimony at his New York civil fraud trial. Trump later told reporters,
"It's a case that should have never been brought, and it's a case that should be immediately dismissed."
Attorney General Letitia James on what's next.
We look forward to hearing the testimony of Ivanka Trump on Wednesday, and then we plan on closing our case.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says in an ABC News interview that they will take overall security responsibility of Gaza after the war with Hamas. Israel Defense Forces expect to soon advance on Gaza City. Spokesman Daniel Hagari through an interpreter.
IDF forces reached the seashore in the southern part of Gaza City, and they encircled it. Now there exists a South Gaza and a North Gaza.
It's believed to be one of the largest single-location drug seizures in New England history. Joshua Levy, acting U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts, has announced the seizure of over 220 pounds of drugs from a home in Lynn, some of which was shaped like Valentine's Day candy.
There are more doses seized in this one house in Lynn than there are people in Massachusetts.
Still no classes in Portland, Oregon. Word is the teachers and school district are far apart on wages and other issues. Superintendent Guadalupe Guerrero says Portland public schools are dealing with a cash crunch.
With our current proposal, PPS will be required to make $51 million in budget reductions over the next 3 years.
The Big Ten just put Michigan on notice. CBS's Monica Ricks explains.
Big Ten Commissioner Tony Petitti has formally notified the University of Michigan that it could face disciplinary action from the NCAA for illegal off-campus scouting and sign stealing. The league is still investigating, but Petitti's letter says any evidence of these allegations would break the principles of its sportsmanship policy. Among possible penalties, Coach Jim Harbaugh could be suspended, and the team could face big fines.
This is CBS News.
Make the hiring process work for you. With Indeed's end-to-end hiring solution, you can attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. Start at Indeed.com/credits.
It's Fully Leaded Education Talk. Hard facts with a humorous twist. Check out Busted Pencils, Tuesdays at 7 on The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM WAUK, and on the Civic Media app.
To return $800,000 of COVID relief money after it was found that the money was misused. CRC Employment and Entrepreneurial Services was awarded nearly $3 million in total. Some of that money was spent on an over $2,000 bowling party and paychecks to founder Cynthia Brown and her family. The organization also paid nearly $7,000 to State Senator Lena Taylor for work she did as an attorney. Taylor denies ever receiving any money. The group has 45 days to return the money. Republicans will have a top-tier candidate for U.S. Senate in a month or two. That's according to Wisconsin Republican Party Chairman Brian Schimming. He says that Tammy Baldwin is not guaranteed re-election. Democratic Party Chairman Ben Wickler says he expects that Republican to be Madison businessman Eric Hovde. I'm Nate Wiggehout, Civic Media News.
Craig Counsell to the Chicago Cubs. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Craig Counsell agreeing to a new contract as the manager of the Chicago Cubs worth $40 million over the next 5 years, nearly $8 million per year, making him the highest paid manager in Major League Baseball history. Now, last week, the Brewers had said that they would match any offer for Counsell as he met with the Cleveland Guardians and then the New York Mets. The Cubs have now fired their manager, David Ross, after 4 years. He still had 1 year left on his contract. The Cubs issuing a press release thanking Ross for his services. Craig Counsell, who managed the crew for 9 seasons and led them to the postseason, postseason five times, had this to say after losing last month to Arizona in the playoffs.
This was a great team. And I think I told the guys, I said, you know, as you move forward in your careers, you should want to create teams like this. You should use your leadership to create an atmosphere like this. This was a team you want to be on.
That's Craig Counsell with Sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Don't change the station, but do watch out for deer, would ya? You know, they're running around all willy-nilly. It is the Krebscast with me, Charlie Behrens, on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. Mainly cloudy skies tonight with a low of 39. Northwest winds 8 to 15 miles an hour. Tomorrow, high of 48. Chance for scattered showers tomorrow night, 42. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Eric Height. Currently, it's 55 degrees.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app. Broadcasting to Waukesha at 101.1 FM. Broadcasting to Southeast Wisconsin at 540 AM. This is The Shaw, WAUK.
Help farmers fight climate change and diversify by harvesting renewable energy.
We're investing nearly $20 billion to help farmers and ranchers tackle climate crisis through climate-smart agriculture and cover crops, nutrient management, reducing greenhouse gas emissions while improving overall health of the soil and the water.
Did you hear that, farmers and ranchers? Did you hear who's actually helping you out? For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter at Green News Report.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, you know, I remember the Occupy years. In fact, we spent a lot of time in Harrisburg at the encampment there, made our way to Zuccotti Park in New York. A couple of times were there. And, you know, look, I remember at the time the mainstream media said, oh, this is just a bunch of hippies who, you know, a bunch of, you know, do-nothings who have no agenda. And the reality is, if you'd have paid attention, they were doing some really important organizing and had a very clear agenda. I don't know how the 99% versus the 1% got missed in all of that. But I'd say out of that, that whole organizing across the country brought us to where we are today. And here to talk about how we got from there to here is a guy who's actually written the book, Be the Revolution, How Occupy Wall Street and the Bernie Sanders Movement Reshaped American Politics, written by Jay Ponte. You can check that out at jayponte.com or betherevolution.us. Jay, thanks for taking time for us.
Brother Rick, thanks for having me on. Working class hero.
So I'm in this spot where, you know, I remember the Occupy days very well. We spent a lot of time, a lot of overnights, you know, talking about what we wanted, what we were building towards, with the future we wanted to have, and did I think the groundwork of organizing that we're kind of seeing bear fruit right now in the labor movement, as you're seeing more people wanting unions, more people striking, and I think that's kind of what your book's about, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, first off, this book is supposed to sort of challenge the general mythos that Occupy failed and Bernie Sanders came out of the free market because he appealed to unrealistic millennials. And really this book smashes that narrative because we can see a through line from Occupy. We can see the impact that Occupy had in fundamentally changing the consciousness of this country. And then you see all of the people who were activated. It was such a powerful activation. And the book actually references Occupy Harrisburg directly with our friend and brother Brett Banditelli. So there's a whole chapter about how Occupy activists, you know, some people, you know, left Occupy having seen how the state coordinated with the mayors coordinated with private industry to really crush us, coordinated with the police to crush the movement. And that was a really profound awakening. For me, it was, I had a moment where I was at the occupation in LA, in Los Angeles, and I got hit in the ribs with a baton. And that was a huge moment for me where, you know, it really, shifted my worldview leftward. But at the same time, you remember, while we were getting our asses handed to us by jackbooted, cops, we saw, 83 or 84 people got elected to Congress with the Tea Party, with their wackadoodle movement. And so a lot of people, some people like Brett Banditelli, Charles Lenchner, and the People for Bernie came away from Occupy knowing that there needed to be a twofold strategy where we also occupied the structures of power and proceeded to, enroll Bernie Sanders. You also had Tim Carpenter and PDA trying to push Bernie to run. They activated the Occupy network to create 99's events for the 99%, which really became the movement ahead of Bernie before he even declared. And this is profoundly important. We can definitely trace a through line through the modern labor movement that we're seeing now.
Yeah, no, I mean, but this is history repeating itself. I mean, you go back, into the, the 1880s and the organizing that laid its tracks into the 20s and until eventually the 30s, where you got the Fair Labor Standards Act and you got some, the National Labor Relations Act, and you got a lot of legislation that helped, create the most prosperous working class in history. That didn't just happen. That happened because people were in the streets for decades organizing and fighting for change. And I saw Occupy as kind of the beginning of that. Them, the Home Defenders League, a bunch of organizations throughout these last, couple of decades that have really, fought to bring people to the public square.
Well, and if you remember too, we also talk about how the progressive movement, now think about it in context with the neoliberals, the third way Democrats, and then a post 9/11 world. So 9/11 really shook anything resembling a populist leftist movement, really shook it to its core. And you also have, the neoliberals, the third way Democrats really taking control and basically, kind of becoming the Republican light. And so until Dennis Kucinich's campaign, and then out of that, you see the out of the convention in 2004, you see Tim Carpenter form PDA, and Charles Lenchner was also part of that. And you have the birth of what you might call the progressive movement. But really, take it in context, it was not a big time for, before Occupy, you couldn't even any frame about the oligarchy or the billionaire class would be framed as class war and not in a good way.
Oh, no, right? I know. Look,
talk about these things.
We started this radio program in 2005. And one of the things that I had mentioned to a prospective funder, I had gone a union, a big union, and I'm not going to name it, but a big union representing, a million plus. So that narrows it down to a very few. I said, we want to take on the neoliberals. And we want to take on that whole neoliberal agenda. We want to return power and the whole class war stuff. And he said to me, leaned in, he goes, a lot of our friends are neoliberals. And clearly, obviously, we didn't get any funding from him. But it was that the power, that agenda had risen to that level.
I'm shocked. That's shocking to me.
No, you're not. But that's the point. I mean, it had taken such hold that even an organization that was supposed to be fighting that had already accepted it.
Yep, absolutely. And eventually, as we get to the end of the book, you can see the birth of, in a post Bernie 2016, 2020 world, we really see that energy continued, and really helped a lot of those organizers. A lot of the Bernie organizers went on to help give birth to the ALU and, the Starbucks a lot of the energy around the rebirth of American labor. And you also see a big sort of a battle between the rank and file and the bottom up energy and that sort of top down old school, the bosses who became very entrenched in the establishment, right, in the political establishment, and, decades of selling out the American worker, which I think Thomas Frank really deftly broke down his book, Listen, Liberal. I think that was also a great book that people should read.
No, but you know, you could also look at Joe Biden. Joe Biden was a classic neoliberal. I mean, he was for decades. He was there. He was on the free trade kicks. He was on all of that stuff. And now he's the guy, and we could agree or disagree, but he seems to be the guy that is pushing back against neoliberalism, not a huge way, not outwardly, but the talk of reshoring manufacturing, the talk of investing and having an infrastructure and an industrial policy, that unheard of.
Yeah, and I think that also the IRA, so anything that has been won, it must be understood, though, that let's just say Occupy and those Bernie Sanders campaigns never happened, we would be looking at a very, very different Biden administration.
Correct.
A very different one. So that is only because of the energy awakened by working class people, by people who are fighting for progressive values, you know, and that is really coming out of, you can really trace that back. And I think you can, you know, make a strong, I also suggest that the WTO battle for Seattle in 99 had its also like was an important trigger point. But you can trace this lineage definitely back to Occupy, and you can see how that, you know, reverberated and the people who were awakened, you know, they tried to bury us, but we were seeds, you know, like it didn't, Occupy never failed. We, you know, people from Occupy went on to do strike debt and to organize for $15 minimum wage, which of course is too low. But, you know, in 2011, that was still considered a revolutionary idea. And you can see gains made. You know, we won public banking in California. That should have never happened. But we won, like a small group of us, the California Public Banking Alliance, actually passed public banking on a state level, which should never have happened. We could go on and on to see the influence that Occupy's had over the last 10 or 12 years.
You listen to the Rick Smith Show with Jay Ponte. He's the author of Be the Revolution, How Occupy Wall Street and the Bernie Sanders Movement Reshaped American Politics. You can find that at betherevolution.us. You can also check out Jay Ponte's website at jayponte.com. We'll get links out on social media, how you can take a look at that. You know, one of the things that I talk about here on my program, as I've been doing this since Labor Day of 2005, and the first interview that I did on my own, was with Bernie Sanders back when he was a congressman that nobody knew. He was the only independent congressman, had been the longest serving independent. And that Bernie is the same Bernie that you hear today, talking about the same kind of worker empowerment, the same kind of working class issues. And that's what I love about Bernie, is he hasn't really changed on the issues. They've just got him nicer clothes and combed his hair a little bit. But
he still looks like he combs his hair with a balloon.
You know, but they did dress him up a little bit, but it's the issues for me that were most important back then and still today. So how do we move this forward? Because clearly Bernie's not the future of the movement. Where is the future? Where do we go from here? And I know you guys do some activist training around this to get people on board. What does that look like?
So for me, one of the things that the book distinguishes is the Bernie campaign from the movement. And this should be understood because they're very different things. You know, I had a chance to work with the campaign in both 2016 and 2020 as a surrogate organizer and wrangler. But it should be understood that those are distinct things. And Bernie, because of his policy platform, was that the campaign itself was a lightning rod for climate justice, for health justice, for economic justice, for all of these, for racial justice. So all these issues. And it created this giant tent movement. So, but for me, like once the Bernie campaign in 2016, 2020 dissipated, broke up, was over, we really saw there was some fracturing. For me, the theory of change is we really must understand that the war, the movement against immoral wars, the movement against the emerging oligarchy, for economic justice, for Medicare for all, for climate justice, as we're moving into the climate apocalypse full steam, the movement for labor, these are all interdependent, and we have to disavow the idea that, number one, some politician is going to save us. They're not. It is really up to us. This is one thing I think Occupy got wrong, is that, you know, we said there are no leaders, when I think really the takeaway should have been we were all leaders, because that is the truth. And I think the pathway forward really comes down to, first, I tend to focus on the local level. It's very hard to move the needle on a federal level. It's very difficult to make change in a federal level, but it is astonishing how much change you can make at a municipal and state level. So I always recommend, you know, getting the organizers for those movements together, having them understand that these issues are interlinked. It's part of the same fight. And it's not a new idea. It's, you know, Fred Hampton's Rainbow Coalition. But yeah, we're going around the country doing trainings, bringing these local activists together, which shockingly are often not working together at all, to help them create a framework and create the solidarity so that they can make changes on a policy level and build people power. So that's really the theory of change that we're advocating.
See, as a labor guy, I keep saying that, you know, if you want to reunite this country, reunionize it. You know, get people together in a room, you know, fighting for a common goal, better wages, hours, conditions, opportunities, that kind of stuff. And then everything else will find its way to being figured out. Once you're in the same room, heading in a similar direction. Does this idea play into what you're talking about?
Absolutely. I mean, labor is an enormous component of that. You know, it's a huge component. You know, and in some ways, you know, a lot of these other movements are very anarchic, decentralized. You know, there isn't strong, you know, structural leadership. Unions have more of that. They tend to have, they're better financed, they're better organized. You know, they've been doing it forever. They've already built power. And I think it's how it plays in is seeing more of that power shift to the rank and file. And I think we're seeing that in real time. There have been some real battles within the labor movement, seeing that the power is not just controlled by you know, some of the union bosses, but is also, you're seeing the rank and file have more autonomy and more influence in the collective bargaining process.
Well, I think you saw that with the UAW strike. I think you saw that with the UAW strike and Sean Fain saying, look, you know, it's not about me, it's about the members. And that's that. And the same thing with Sean O'Brien with the Teamsters. The Teamsters fought that fight years ago to get one person, one vote to reclaim their power. And I think it has done a reasonable job of getting decent contracts and moving us in a positive direction. But again, I come back to the idea that, you know, if we're gonna reunite this country, it's got to be done where we all, you know, have something similar that we're fighting for. And I think wages, hours, conditions, the important part of this. If someone wanted to get involved and take one of these trainings or outside of buying the book, and I highly suggest it, it's Be the Revolution, How Occupy Wall Street and the Bernie Sanders Movement Reshaped American Politics by Jay Ponte. We'll get links out on social media, or just check out the website, betherevolution.us.
Yeah, so the best way is if they go on Be the Revolution, there's a free bonus chapter. If you sign up for that bonus chapter, it's basically an autopsy of why Trump won. And spoiler alert, neoliberalism has a lot to do with it. You know, it was based on an article I wrote called 27 Reasons That Trump Won That Have Nothing to Do with Susan Sarandon. But if you sign up for and download that chapter, your email will be registered. And you can reach out. You can reach out to me directly and let me know where you're at. And we're going to plan a national tour. So if you're in Des Moines or Boston or Atlanta, let me know where you're at. And if you want to be part of organizing something in your city, let us know. We'd love to help.
No, that would be fantastic. I hope people will check out that site, betherevolution.us, and also your site, jponte.com. We'll get links out on social media. Now, I got an email here, you know, just popped into my box, and it's kind of lengthy, and I don't want to go through all of it, but because there are a lot of words that I'm not allowed to say on radio. But this person's saying that, you know, the Bernie movement is the reason that Trump got elected. Thoughts?
Oh, first off, I would really highly recommend either you can just go on and Google 27 reasons Trump won that have nothing to do with Susan Sarandon, or you can download sort of an edited, it's a little more of a polished chapter on betherevolution.us. And I answer that in about there's an 80,000 word, you know, breakdown and autopsy. And you know, we have to look at the facts. The facts are actually, Bernie supporters showed up to vote for Secretary Clinton in greater numbers than Hillary Clinton supporters showed up to a vote for Obama in 2008. Okay, so the numbers are actually really clear. And, you know, they're like, I really recommend looking at that chapter because I get into it very deep. We look at a lot of factors from her net favorables to the fact that the Democratic Party spent $1 billion on consultants who gave sage advice like, don't campaign in Wisconsin or Michigan, you know?
And hold a rush hour concert with Bruce Springsteen in Philadelphia.
Yeah, exactly. Like it just, you know, we have to also get past the point that in 2016, a populist was always going to win. And the way that populism goes is it either goes FDR, where we working class people stand up for economic inequality, or it goes the way of the strong man and Hitler. So FDR or Hitler. And, you know, one of the cautionary tales of this book is that if you stifle healthy populist movements, you get Trump or DeSantis or some fascist who's even worse. There's an entire chapter on who was behind QAnon and the insurrection. And it is a cautionary tale because you can see directly how the stifling of these movements and campaigns led to the you know, created a lane for the neo-fascist to take over. So
good stuff. Again, the book Be the Revolution by Jay Ponte. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Jay, great talking with you. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Anytime. I love it. Love talking about the working man. Working people, we'll say.
There you go. Thanks so much, Jay.
The 99%. Thanks, Rick.
Appreciate it. Again, make sure you check out the book, Be the Revolution. BeTheRevolution.us. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, make sure you check out the book, Be the Revolution, betherevolution.us, if you want to take a look at it. And look, you know, I remember the Occupy days. You know, like I said, we spent a lot of time in those places, you know, talking to the people who were there. The thing that was annoying to me, and I got to be honest, was the chanting, the people's mic. And I know people loved it, but it just seemed like such a difficult way to get just people to talk. And I think some people, and this was the part that, you know, that got me, is you'd have some people who would stand up and talk just to hear people repeat their words. But the organizing that came out of that was, I think, really important and really incredible. And you needed that. And I remember saying at the time, this may not change the world, but it's going to be the seeds that spring what will change. And the fact that it was hyper-local, you know, I say all the time, if you want to change the world, change your little piece of it. It's that simple. And this has started to do it. Now, you know, look, the big money, honestly, they control everything we see, hear, and read. The reason that you see some of the polling happening the way it's been going has been, you know, the fact that they've saturated the airwaves. You've got the F channel and Newsmax and, oh, you know, one of news and this and that. Every right-wing corporate neoliberal mouthpiece out there spewing off the same page. It's very infrequent that working people get working class news, which is why I think it's so important that we still read books like Jay's book. And I highly suggest it.
But again, I come back to this idea. We have to come back together. And when I say we need to reunionize our workplaces, I believe that. Because look, we don't have to agree on every issue, but we do have to find that common thread.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK.
CBS News Brief. A federal jury finds scuba dive boat captain Jerry Boylan criminally negligent in the death of 34 people during a 2019 boat fire off California's coast. Loyola Law School professor Lori Levinson says the statute Boylan was found guilty of is known as seaman's manslaughter.
In that statute, which goes back to before the Civil War, captains of boats and their crews are responsible for maritime disasters.
Former President Trump wraps up testimony in his New York civil fraud trial. CBS's Graham Cates.
It was very reminiscent of some of his debate performances. Long, long-winded answers, a refusal to just say yes or no to a question, and a constant combative tone toward both the judge and the lawyers who are questioning him.
Acting U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts Joshua Levy says they've seized a lot of drugs from a home in Lynn.
9.2 kilos of fentanyl that's made to be designed to look like candy.
Three people charged with drug trafficking. CBS News Brief. I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
This is your hometown radio, Refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
For Civic Media News, I'm Nate Wiggehout. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. The University of Wisconsin is out with a $32 million workforce development plan. It's the system's attempt to recover money Republicans cut from state universities in the state budget. The budget lets the universities recover the money if it's spent on workforce development and not diversity efforts. Republicans are also holding up pay raises for faculty and staff until Wisconsin universities cut diversity spending. State lawmakers considering spending taxpayer money on American Family Field have some more to think about after taking a tour of the Brewers Stadium. The bill that passed the assembly would spend more than $500 million in public money. But for now, there aren't enough votes to pass the Senate. Governor Evers says he would sign a bill if it were to pass in the legislature. I'm Nate Wiggehout, Civic Media News.
The Todd Alba Show.
I had tweeted out after the second game of the year, a hot take. I said, by the end of the year, we will see Braden Locke as the starting quarterback of the Wisconsin Badgers. Now, Mr. Mordecai broke his hand. And by golly, not the way I thought it would happen, but Braden Locke has become the starting quarterback.
And another finger on the monkey's paw curls.
Where did you get that one?
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Your hometown radio refreshed. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
Here's your updated forecast on The Shaw. Mainly cloudy skies tonight with a low of 39. Northwest winds 8 to 15 miles an hour. Tomorrow, high of 48. Chance for scattered showers. Tomorrow night, 42. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Derek Height. Currently, it's 50 degrees.
Matt Flynn Direct.
When it comes to shutting down the government, what I'm afraid is Mike Johnson comes in, he'll say, real smooth, I don't want to shut down the government. Here's a budget. And you'll go, hey, wait a minute. That has cuts in child care, Social Security. And he'll smile. He's sort of like Scott Walker. People who are unnervingly polite behind that kind of facade, they have a lot of inner weasels. They have too many inner weasels, quite frankly.
Matt Flynn Direct. Weekdays from 2 until 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. It's never personal, only politics. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show with Dom and Kreutz. Weekdays from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Your home for the Devil's Advocates. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6 on The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
Who could be against that? The people, it turns out. While some families might want exclusive private schools, their claim that they have no choice is a fraud. As one GOP legislator put it, his rural county has, quote, private schools, a parochial school, a charter school, and a large homeschool community. That is choice, he rightly notes. Who are the privatizers? National billionaires like the Koch brothers. And in Texas, we have Tim Dunn and Ferris Wilkes, two messianic oil billionaires from West Texas who double as proselytizers of a toxic theology of Christian nationalism. They are the money gods of school privatization. Indeed, the governor, more than half of Texas House members, and every Republican state senator are financially hooked on their oil money. This is Jim Hightower saying, no matter what slogan the privatizers masquerade behind, their goal is simply to defund public schools and divert our education dollars from the common good to their corporate and theological academy. Ask yourself, what would Jesus do?
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, she's going to endorse Donald Trump on Wednesday. And why Wednesday, do you ask? Well, evidently, she's going to be going from her little state there of Arkansas. And maybe she's going to take the lectern slacks podium with her. maybe that's coming. But yeah, she's going to endorse Trump on Wednesday, specifically on Wednesday, going from Arkansas to Miami. Going to take a little vacation in Miami where she can give her little endorsement. And why Wednesday, you ask, Bertel? That is a debate night. And I got to tell you, I don't know why you would come. I don't know why Trump would highlight debate night, because I don't think anybody else is paying attention to it, because literally nobody's paying attention to it. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the big endorsement. And if this is it, this is what's going to get Donald over the hump. Our good friend, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick. You know what I just realized?
Do tell.
I do the news notes, as you know, put them out to the stations I'm on. And I just realized for the first time in 13, 14 years, I forgot to include debate night tomorrow. Seriously, I didn't realize. I've never done that before.
Well, you still have a chance. It's Wednesday, so you can still pop
in. Oh, I know, but and if I didn't hear you right now, I would have went past Wednesday with the news notes. So, wow.
Because nobody's paying attention. None of these people on that stage have a chance.
I didn't pay attention, yeah.
All right, well, so what do you think? Any thoughts on debate night, or we just skip right over that?
No, look, they're keeping themselves alive for one reason. They're hoping, I think, that Biden drops out with Harris. And if Biden, I've argued this 100 times, but if Biden drops out with Harris, Trump's done. Biden can beat Trump, and Trump can beat Biden, if that makes sense,
yep.
If you look at the polls.
They're close.
Yeah, they're close. If Biden and Harris are not there, I would argue whoever comes in, Trump immediately loses a lot of the support he had, because maybe the independents, the undecideds, et cetera, go to a new person, and I think the polling would show him in pretty bad shape. So I think that's what they're all hoping for. What else would you hope for? Think about it.
Yeah, or, you know, he goes to jail or, you know, something along those
lines. Yeah, even that one, they're indirectly outside hoping for that, but there's an appeals process and, you know, the whole nine yards.
And speaking of court, today there was, you know, Trump did a little song and dance. Are you surprised by the performance?
Yes, surprised.
Really? Surprised that he was going to throw a temper tantrum and attack the judge and the prosecutor? You're surprised at that?
Yes, I actually thought it would be a bit toned down. I really did.
No, see, I thought he was going to go full-on crazy.
Oh, I didn't. But then when he did, I thought about it. And the judge, if you look at what the judge said, first of all, he was saying, you know, and they took it out of the context of Trump lawyers later, but he said, you know, I don't want to hear what you have to say. And if you look at the total context, he's saying, I want you to answer yes or no questions. He didn't say, I don't want to hear what you have to say, and I make a judgment call. In other words, he didn't do that.
Right.
But I thought about this today. Why not become unhinged if he's Trump? Because if you're the judge, seriously, you've got to sit there and normally you would bang the gavel probably after a period of time because the judge kind of went back on what he said.
No, that kind of went completely back.
Yeah.
He said,
yeah.
Now, if you can't keep your client in check, I will. And then let Trump get even worse from what I read.
Then he let him get worse. Yeah, so, yeah, you're right. Not kind of. He did. But why did he do that? And I was thinking, if you're the judge sitting there in this unique case, you've got to say in your mind, okay, this is, he's baiting me. If I bang the gavel and say contempt of court, put him in a cell, really?
Yep.
You want to talk about the martyr syndrome?
Yeah, absolutely.
Or if I bang the gavel and say you can't control your client, he doesn't speak anymore, I've truly silenced him. I think the judge realized it was a bait.
Yep.
It was a bait.
See, now, this is where my thought was. If I'm the judge, I don't even make that threat from the beginning. I just say, you keep talking stupid. You know,
right.
Keep digging yourself a hole. And I've said this all along with all of the judges who have been saying, you know, we want you to curtail your social media or any of that. I say, keep talking stupid. You know, keep digging yourself that deeper hole.
Right. You know, humans are funny because I don't know if you remember years back, there was a big movement and the Tea Party people went to the town halls, you know, things like that.
It was big around here.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I knew a Democrat congressman was a really good friend of mine. He's deceased now. And he called me up and he said, what do you think? I said, look, you go to the town hall and you listen to this stuff and it's irritating, et cetera. And you listen to the stuff. I said, I don't think you hold a bunch of town halls after that, but you tough it out, you know? And that's what the judge, I think, this is sort of like the town hall.
Yep.
The judge has to tough it out. And all the judges have to tough certain things out. This is not a normal case where you can bang that gavel and the result is, you know, the person sitting there goes, oh, I better behave myself. Doesn't happen that way.
No. As I said at the beginning, the reality is this plays to the Trump base because anybody who feels that the system has done them wrong, this is a guy taking on the system. This is a guy who's thumbing his nose. And look, you know, ultimately, you know, on a political sense, this is going to be good for him. I just don't know on a business sense. And obviously, this is a civil trial. He's on the hook potentially for $250 million. I don't know how smart it is financially for a guy who is, you know, supposedly art of the deal. I don't know if this is a very good deal.
Well, remember something too. Think about this: the court at the end of the day, in these cases, picks a, I don't know if you want to call him a regulator, but somebody that manages the business. You know, there was a TV show where this happened in one of the TV shows. And I remember they would fight back and forth with this guy. Can you imagine if you were the person that had every morning had to sit with Trump and argue about how the business was going to run that? Think about it. Would you not jump out of the top of a building in a week? And then you get a new one in? Huh?
Yeah, no, that you got a point.
Okay.
You got a point. There's nothing good there. Let me ask you about the polling numbers. I'm sure you've seen the Siena College poll. Not good. I know it's a year out. Actually, a year out. Any thoughts on the polling?
Yes. I had a friend of mine call me today, and she is what I would deem to be pretty well to the left of the left, very educated and very left to the left, and is, you know, has nothing good to say about Trump, and called me today and said this has to be wrong. And I said, that's where you're going to go wrong. This has to be taken serious because it's not so much, well, it's a point where, you know, Biden's losing 5 of the 6 battleground states, but it's not that as much as I'm in absolute shock because this is unprecedented in modern times. But Trump is now registering 22% support from black voters in these states. That hasn't been seen for a Republican in a long, long time in our modern times, right? Also, I looked at this with the President Israel Hamas situation and Palestinians. the young vote was like 1%, single digits, I should say, to Biden's favor. And right now, a lot of young voters are really into the, you know, Palestinian side of things, I believe. And so that's, you know, an interesting factor, probably, you know, for Michigan in particular. But the voters under 30 favor Biden by a single percentage point. The other thing about these polls, which I it baffles me completely, if you look at Biden and his positions on Israel and then the voters in the polling on Israel, Biden has done exactly what they think should be done, 67% of the people. Yet when they're polled, they say, but Biden hasn't done enough what he should. So I'm looking at this and then the economics, and then I saw the answer from the Biden campaign, and they're going to have to sharpen their pencils here. Their answer was, you know, basically radical extremists, you know. Well, you know, can say that, but when you start to look at 22% of the black voters supporting Trump, let's not put them in the radical extremist category.
No, that's a good point.
Yeah. So this is a warning to the Biden campaign that they are not getting a message somehow. It is short-circuiting between the White House and the public.
And what do you think has caused that? What do you think has brought that on? You know, is it a policy thing? You know, I had someone earlier point out the fact that the child tax credit went away is maybe a reason why a lot of working class voters are struggling so much and down on the economy, which, again, Republicans are the ones who fought against. But, you know, does that play into it? You know, what do you see as the, or is it just, hey, you know, things haven't gotten much better under Biden that they can see, and they're pining for the good old days? Any thoughts?
Well, technically, things, you know, Biden inherited certain things that were a detriment, and technically some things have gotten better. That message hasn't gotten through. People have this kind of underlying, you know, fear. I think it's a post-COVID deal, personally. That's where I think some of this, you know, comes from. But on top of it, I believe that the Biden campaign has made, in the Biden White House, they're intermixed, you know how it runs. But, Rick, I think they've made the mistake that Biden warned Obama about when he was vice president. Biden was smart. He went to Obama and said, you did an issue, and you just said, oh, here it is. How, look how great. And then you moved on without cementing the issue. And so I think the White House, in what it's done, has just moved on, you know, too quickly and not gotten that issue out there. I'll give you a perfect example. Now, some listeners may not like this example, but I'll give you one. The border has issues. I mean, it simply does. It has issues of people coming across, et cetera. And I know some people within the progressive side are not particularly happy with Biden, but how many people, that not radical, but how many people in the middle are like, hey, I'm kind of worried about border security. How many people know that Biden's actually done something about it? I don't think they do.
No, they don't.
I don't think they have any concept that he's done anything about it.
Especially because you hear Republicans constantly hammering on that he's done nothing.
That he's opened the borders, blah, 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 on and on and on. When in reality, Biden, at the point where he's had, you know, some of the progressives angry at him, Biden has done some things to fortify the border. He recently stop the ability, you know, if you're not coming in with a family, to just come in and say, oh, I'm here. You know, he changed some of that criteria. So he's done some things. He's talked about refortifying some of the spots where people can get through. I don't want to get into the wall thing, you know,
right. But
he's done that. And there's zero knowledge or credit for that. I mean, that's just one thing that I can, you know, I can point out. I guess the second thing is, I ask myself, I sit here, and you know, I'm a news junkie like you, et cetera, but I'm sitting here thinking, okay, where's he at on student loans right now? What's happened with that? Did he do something, or did, you know, it's not ingrained out there, you know, enough.
And I would argue, you know, the reality is that the right has built a massive media machine. be it, you know, talk radio where they're completely dominant, cable news where they dominate, online they have an enormous presence, a much better digital strategy and much better digital plan than the Democrats have. They have messaging down, whereas as I keep saying about Biden, he's just a guy who gets up every day and does the work. And you know, like my friends in the labor movement, they don't take credit for anything. They don't toot their own horn. They don't do any of that stuff. And maybe they should spend a little time saying, "Hey, look at the great stuff we're doing."
Yeah, that goes back to what I just said about Biden when he warned Obama, move on too fast. You're not letting this sink in. Well, now I think he needs to heed, his own words, and they need to get out there. The other thing is, look, people will consider MAGA, as way out there, or all the MAGA people are way out there, or some of them are, or whatever. I think that in itself is a theme that's out there, and people made decisions. I think the campaign needs to not ride that theme that the answer to everything is, Trump's out there. We know he's out there.
That's why his base loves him.
Yeah, he's out there. And so them saying the camp, which they answer to the polling, it's the radical, people are going to see this. Well, I still say bring it back to the issues, bring it straight home to the issues. And Biden, at this point in time, I would put the squeeze on the oil companies. I would do that. How about the pharmaceutical ideas that he had, and the Medicare? What about all of that?
Yeah.
So I'm saying, he's got to energize tooting his own horn, but you are completely right. The right has dominated the airwaves.
We're a top one, a Talkers 100 top program.
Right.
We're closing down on December 1st.
Yeah.
Because there are no resources to make this. And there aren't enough platforms for us to continue on. We've grown to the limits that there is possible on this side of the aisle. And that's a sad testament to the fact that they've built no infrastructure for this, for their messaging. I mean, it's not like I'm a paid DNC guy, but I like a lot of the policies that Biden has moved forward on. I like the investments that we're making in the future of this country. I love the fact that his labor secretary is doing some really great work. I love the fact that his NLRB is doing incredible stuff. That is all stuff that no working person really knows is going on, and they should be hammering on this. They should be every day talking about it. But
right, sadly, go to my point. Because you've been a voice of working people, and it's the perfect issue, because you know what? It's a true issue. And how did Trump capture the votes against Hillary? I know. Trade, working people, he got, you'd have thought he was a labor leader when he was running, right?
And he showed up
there. Yeah, and so that's what needs to happen on the radio waves, which you do perfectly, and that type of investment needs to happen, and that people spend money on all kinds of other foolish things. So I don't get it, but that's where he has to hammer home for working people what working people care about.
Yep.
And of course, this all gets so off track on so many other things, and right now, of course, Israel and Palestinians is the, dominant thing.
That's tearing us apart.
And it is. And then the other thing, too, is, okay, you got the speaker and he's way out there, and I understand all that, but what about, the White House can recognize, hey, he's out there, but here's what we want to do. And they need to get Democrats in the House to sponsor their initiatives. And if the initiatives don't get a vote, you keep hammering it that you want to vote, and you bring it up. You bring it up in 1 minute on the floor. You make motions. You do that. You force the Republicans to turn down something that working people say, wow, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
But you got to get it out there.
You got to do the work. That's, sure. It's that simple.
Absolutely.
Real quick, Ohio, how are things going to go on Election Day?
Well, I'm going to go, issue one wins. It does a yes. Like I said the other night, it's Ohio. I don't know. It's been so non-existent on issue two. I think maybe issue two doesn't make it. I could be wrong.
Okay, so So abortion is going to be safe and legal in Ohio after this.
Yes.
It'll be a constitutional amendment on issue one, but no legal pot. Is that where you're going?
That's what I'm thinking, only because nobody has breathed a word on issue two. So everybody, you know, issue one, you're going, oh, okay, I read that, I'm going to vote yes on issue one. Issue two, what the heck is that?
Yeah.
I didn't know that one. Boom.
Will the stoners get out to vote?
They might forget. It's election day, you know? You never know.
Well, you forgot Wednesday's debate night, so it's possible.
Yeah, I did. I sure did.
But, well, Bob, I appreciate the time. As always, good stuff, my friend.
Thank you, Rick.
Our good friend Bob Nay. Let's take a quick break right back to wrap things up. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the top. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1860. That was the day that Abraham Lincoln was elected 16th President of the United States. When Lincoln came to office, the nation was deeply divided on the question of slavery. By December 20th, South Carolina had seceded from the United States. Less than a month later, Confederate soldiers fired on Fort Sumter in South Carolina. With those shots, it became clear the issue of slavery would be settled by a civil war. The first year of the war was not going well for the Union. In December 1861, President Lincoln sat down to pen his annual message to Congress. In 1934, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt renamed that annual message the State of the Union. The speech still goes by that name today. By all accounts, the State of the Union was very grim in 1861. 11 states had seceded and were at war with the Union. Lincoln's long message to Congress included a summary of the war as well as foreign relations. But it ended with Lincoln's thoughts about the nature of work and labor in the United States. It included some of the most famous words ever uttered by a sitting president about labor. Lincoln wrote, "Labor is prior to and independent of capital. Capital is only the fruit of labor and could have never existed if labor had not first existed. Labor is superior of capital and deserves much the higher consideration." Lincoln ended his address by noting that the war that embroiled the nation would have a profound impact, not just on the current generation fighting. He wrote that the conflict would shape the vast future of the nation. Lincoln was felled by an assassin's bullet. He did not live to see that vast future after the Civil War. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I look at Election Day, Tuesday. Hope folks were going to get out and vote. I'm looking forward to being able to do that. Election Day, I love Election Day. It's one of those things that, you know, when our kids were really small, we would drag them along. So they saw, you know, participation, being part of you know, the process of self-governance, important stuff. And I would hate losing that. And I know a lot of people have said, hey, you know, if Trump becomes president again, last ever election, I don't know. I think they'll still have them. They'll just be shams. But a couple of things that I'm going to be paying attention to on Election Day. The Virginia legislature, for instance, is a big one. Youngkin got kind of a push because of the crazy Moms for Liberty types. They weren't then yet, but in the anti-education money that came in that proposed, and look, Terry McAuliffe was a terrible candidate, and basically, you know, blew it with that, you know, your parents don't have a right to nonsense. Be interesting to see where Virginia voters go in deciding their legislature. Ohio, obviously, the country is going to be looking to Ohio to see which way they go on the abortion issue. Personally, I would have preferred this to happen next year as something to get people out, but we'll see. We'll see how many people show up. Typically, in these off-year elections, Democrats don't come out in big numbers, and which is the reason that Republicans moved on this in the state to do it now, because they thought, hey, you know, we can sneak this one by them. We'll throw the old fastball by them while they're not even looking. So we'll see if it does draw people out, and we'll see where if legal pot is something that happens in Ohio as well, which would be kind of weird. Also going to be checking out the gubernatorial races in Kentucky and Mississippi. A possibility of two very, very red states having Democratic governors. That's going to be.
This you're listening to the Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
When it comes to shutting down the government, what I'm afraid is Mike Johnson comes in.